Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can you learn by reading the dictionary? Most people consult one now and then to clarify a definition or confirm the correct spelling of a word. A few among us even like to dive in for a little recreational word hunting on a slow day. But there may be only one man with the stomach, if not the eyesight, to read not just a dictionary, but the granddaddy of them all, the Oxford English Dictionary, from its first entry straight through to its very last. Ammon Shea undertook this remarkable feat a couple of years ago and shares what he learned in his book, Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. The memoir is just out in paperback, and we are delighted to have the author here to talk about it. Ammon, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
After it was all over, you realized that you had gone into this sort of looking for all the elements of a great novel, and then at the end you were not disappointed by that. Can you talk about why you consider the OED the greatest story that you've ever read?
Absolutely. I'm perhaps a little different than some typical readers in that I enjoy reading dictionaries anyway for many reasons. I think they're delightful books to read. But the Oxford English Dictionary in particular, I think, is much more literary than your average dictionary. And the main reason is that it's not just a list of words. They also, more than any other dictionary in the world, they illustrate how the words are used by providing examples of the words as they've been used in literature or in many other forms of writing. So they give the word, the definition, the etymology, but then they'll also give citations showing how the word comes about. So, for instance, if you read throughout the entire thing, you end up reading 33,000 citations by Shakespeare, I think it is. I think 12,500 by Dryden or Pope. I don't remember who's second. But, you know, there are 2.5 million quotations or citations in the dictionary itself. So it's not just a dry word list. It's a beautiful, kind of stunning illustration of how the words are used in our language.
Does that put sort of a narrative arc to the dictionary?
I think that it does. I understand that some people might not share that opinion with me. There's a narrative arc for several reasons. One is that as long as you're not unduly concerned with plot, and doesn't have to make sense in a chronological order, there is a narrative arc just in terms of each letter is a little bit different. For instance, we get to the letter W, suddenly there are no words of, or very, very few words of Latin and or Greek origin for the simple fact that they didn't have W's. You'll see the vocabulary change throughout each letter, throughout each prefix, and you'll get a kind of flavor of the word for several pages or for several hundred pages, as the case may be.
And, in fact, each letter has a different editor, is that correct?
Well, there were four main editors of the first part of the OED, and the main one of them was James Murray, who's really kind of the father of the dictionary more than anybody else. And he edited over half of it, and then there have been other editors since then. But yeah, each editor worked pretty much on their own. So, for instance, the letter E was entirely edited by a man named Bradley, and then there were Craigie and Onions who did their own letters. But James Murray did most of the dictionary. But you'll see, it's very subtle, but you will see changes in how the dictionary was put together from letter to letter on occasion.
How often did you go through this and find that you have been pronouncing a certain word incorrectly?
Constantly. but that's just because, most of the words that I know I've learned through reading, not through speech. It may not come as such a surprise that somebody who reads dictionaries does not have the most varied social life. Quite often, I just know words through books, not through speech. And I'm horrible at pronouncing English and any other language, but especially English. I didn't, to be honest with you, pay so much attention to the pronunciation. But what was more striking to me was how often I would find words for which I was positive that I had always known the meaning. And either A, I was just totally wrong about them, or there would be a word which meant something else completely different for hundreds of years. For instance, the word nice for a long time meant silly or stupid before it became what we think of as nice today. or a word like prodigal. Like many other people, I always thought of the prodigal son as being something akin to prodigy or prodigious, and in fact, it just means somebody who's spent all his money. And that's a word that I think is routinely misused by, in my mind, it's routinely misused by many educated people I know. And so I would find that meanings shift with our vocabulary quite a bit more than one might think.
And there are also a lot of really interesting words that sort of sound like familiar words, and therefore we might assume that they mean something similar, but they mean nothing of the kind.
Yeah, that happens quite a bit. I think prend is a nice little word, and all it means is it's a repaired crack. And it's a kind of, it sounds like, oh yeah, prend, what does that mean? I must have come across prend somewhere else. But, you know, I've never come across prend before I read the dictionary. And it's odd to me because it's such a useful sounding word. I mean, everybody has seen a repaired crack in a cup or in a building or a sidewalk or something. It seems like it's a word of such utility. And yet it's been out of use for hundreds of years now, I think.
Why do you think we lose useful words?
I don't know. I think that's a question for the linguists, and I am definitely not a linguist, either professional or amateur. I think it's just more than, if I were to make a guess, it's just the nature of language that it changes, and it shifts over time. It's inevitable. Pretty much every language is going to change, no matter how hard people try to prevent it. It's just the nature of it.
On the other hand, and we should say that the book includes a lot of words that you include with their definitions that you found particularly interesting. You also seem to have found a lot of words that it wouldn't seem that we have any real need for, and yet there they are in the OED.
Well, that's true. The OED is not, you know, as most dictionaries are, they're not so much interested in whether a word should be in a dictionary. One of the things that makes it such a kind of grand enterprise is that it's this remarkably ambitious project they had, which is that they don't just want to exhibit the English that people use today or the English that people should use. It was really an attempt to show the English as it's been used throughout the history of the language. So they're putting down a lot of words that were used very, very rarely or for a short period of time. And the only really criteria that they had for whether a word goes, when it's the dictionary or not, was whether it was used and if it could be documented as being used. And there have been some phases in our language where people would come up with kind of fanciful words. And maybe they weren't taken very seriously, but they were used. And they don't necessarily have to be useful in order to be delightful. In fact, I am not necessarily at all in favor of using these words in conversation, but you don't have to in order to enjoy them. One of my favorite examples is a word like apricity, which describes the warmth of the sun in wintertime. And I think it's just such a delightful word because when you hear that word and you see it and it gets lodged in your brain, I find, at least for me, I pay much more attention to that concept of the warmth of the sun in the wintertime. So it's not useful for purposes of communication, but it is extremely useful for purposes of enjoyment.
I liked the word gentacular.
Gentacular, relating to breakfast?
Yeah, or pertaining to breakfast. I imagined using it, and then I thought, no, it would sound so ridiculous, but there was something cool about it.
Well, you know, and that's something else that, you know, you said, why do certain words fall out? I mean, why does, you know, I mean, prandial are usually termed postprandial. You know, it's not a very common word, but it's not so uncommon. You hear people talk about postprandial drink or preprandial drink, and that just means before or after dinner. Like I said, it's not very common, but it's not so obscure. But so why is it that words for dinner, such as post or preprandial, have survived, but nobody knows the word for breakfast or the word for lunch, which is senile? Why does nobody know that, oh, yeah, it was a post-senile nap? That just doesn't ever come up in language. It's pretty much died away completely. And I don't know why that is.
So you have to have come on a bunch of words that you were just really inspired to bring back. What did you do with those?
Well, I guess the words that I put into the book and that I wrote about, I don't know if I would say that they're deserving of being resurrected, but there are a number which do seem kind of strangely applicable considering they're never used. One of my favorites is the word Bayard, which is spelled B-A-Y-A-R-D, and it refers to a person. It actually has a lot of different meanings throughout the ages, but the one that really spoke to me the most was it refers to a person who has the self-confidence of the ignorant. And it seems like such an incredibly useful word. Everybody has come across someone and who fits that description. And everybody, when I say I have this word for this thing, everybody, their eyes kind of glaze over for a moment. And you can see that they're thinking of someone that they know, or someone that they've met before. And so I think that as a concept, that kind of person is never going to go away. So it does seem to be a shame in a way that the words that describe it has kind of largely been lost.
Yeah, that one made me think about some clever novelist sort of making that a character's last name or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happened somewhere or there.
There's also a word to describe the way the earth smells right after it's rained.
Uh-huh, yeah, petrichor.
Yeah.
A beautiful word. It's also, considering, again, the smell has been around for ages, it's a relatively recent word. I think it didn't really come into use until 1964, and it was geologists who were writing in Nature magazine, and they came up with this word, and it did stick because it had such utility. And it's just basically the smell that comes from when it first begins to rain, and it comes from when the rain hits the ground or rock. And it's I think it usually results from a kind of, it's basically oil from the ground kind of getting released into the air. But it's such a beautiful, beautiful smell that, again, just like the word for the warmth of the sun in the wintertime, when people hear that word, they think about that smell. So it's not useful for communication, again, but it is useful for your own enjoyment and your own memory.
So have you developed a personal standard, or maybe the better word is philosophy, for when to use obscure words?
Yeah, absolutely, and I try to use them as infrequently as possible. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of using obscure words because it goes against the purposes of speech or communication, as far as I'm concerned. I think the purpose of speaking to someone is, you know, inherent in that is that you're trying to communicate an idea or a sentiment or an emotion to them. And if you throw in a big word, all you really do is you might make them stop the conversation and say, well, what does that mean? And then you have to stop and explain what that word means. And it's like a little roadblock to the conversation. So I don't think that using big words for their own sake has any utility or purpose.
How often when you were reading the dictionary did a definition cause you to have to go look up one of the words within the definition?
Very infrequently, because there's a standard that most lexicographers use, which is that when defining a word, they really do their utmost to not use a word in the definition, which is harder than the word being defined. It's just one of the kind of principles of lexicography. That being said, though, in the OED, they define so many words that every once in a while you come across something like, I think a disjibeline was defined as neither a Guelph nor a Ghibelline. I mean, that just really threw me for a loop. And I did have to stop and go look this up. And it turns out I think there were political parties in Italy in the Middle Ages, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, who were against each other. So, you know, that would come up every once in a while with some of the more obscure words. But for the most part, they do a pretty phenomenal job of explaining things as clearly and succinctly as possible.
Are there a lot of multiple word words?
By multiple word words, what do you mean?
Now I'm trying to think of a good example. When there's three or four words that make up one discrete concept.
No, generally, most of the words that you'll find in there are going to be single words. I mean, every once in a while, there will be things which have been crammed together, like agathocacological, which is a full word, but it's made up of a bunch of Greek roots, and it means being made up of both good and bad qualities, which is itself a kind of nice and seemingly useful word. But it really is just a single word that's been formed out of a bunch of other words.
Amon Shea is my guest. His new book is called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. We will start taking your calls and emails after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Emin Shay is my guest. His new book is called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. Emin, the Oxford English Dictionary is available online in its entirety. What made you decide that you just had to do the hard copy version?
I've always been a fan of books in many, many ways. I think that the way that the OED exists online is kind of marvelous. They do a much, much better job of putting their dictionary online than any other dictionary in the world. And I do use the online version quite often. It's great for searching for words or searching for things within the dictionary. But there's really just nothing like having a book in your lap in order to give you that feeling of reading. And there's so many things about it. I mean, just there's the smell of books, which I find delightful. There's the kind of tactile sensation of moving the pages from one side to the other. There's the seeing the page count move from the right to the left. It gives you a kind of feeling of satisfaction as you know that you're reading. There's just so many things for me that are physical, that are tied into the feeling of reading. I tried reading it online, and it didn't really do anything for me.
On the other hand, this was no easy task physically. You were sort of worn out in the eyes and in the back.
I didn't wear glasses before I began, and I certainly do wear glasses now. It was a direct result of it. But, once you sit down and you start reading something like this, for me, the dictionary, no matter what dictionary it is, but I guess really especially for the OED, it is my favorite book in the world. And I think we're all kind of familiar with this feeling, and it's what I call the incipient sadness that comes over you when you realize that the book that you're reading, which you were so much enjoying, is soon coming to an end. And it's a feeling that soon you will no longer have this book to read anymore. Now, that feeling is delayed considerably when the book that you're reading is almost 22,000 pages long. So that's a very welcome feeling.
You did struggle on occasion to stay focused because you were doing this 8 or 10 hours a day for a year. What did you determine to be the ideal conditions for dictionary perusal?
I spent most of my time in the basement of a local college, the basement of their library, because there were very few people that used it. There were no windows. For me, it worked beautifully to read there because I was in the portion of the library which was all either books on the theater or books written in French. And I'm not very interested in the theater, and I don't read French, so there were very few distractions, even though I was surrounded by books. There were no noises, and there were no windows to look out of. Maybe people think this is strange, but when you really fall into a book, and I think the dictionary is no different than any other book in that sense, you really get transported and lost in the book. And there's no need to have a window to look out of. You're looking into the world by looking through the book.
But you did come home one night and tell your girlfriend that you were afraid you were being viewed as one of the library people.
Yeah, there are the library people, and they're the ones who, come to the library with several bags full of newspapers and we talk to themselves. And I did pick up some of the characteristics of the library people, and I think the workers, the librarians, kind of viewed me as one of the library people. But I would consider that a small price to pay for the enjoyment that I got from reading the dictionary.
How much did you pay, by the way, for your OED?
I bought it online. I bought it used, and it wasn't that much. I bought it for about $500. But you can buy a full set now for, I think, about $1,000, which, on the one hand, it's a large amount of money for a book. But on the other hand, I'm sure most people have spent $1,000 on things of far less use than a dictionary, which can really last you your entire lifetime. It's cheaper than a big flat-screen TV, and it's, I think, far more enjoyable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jane in Dallas. Hello, Jane.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I was wondering if he could tell us if there is a word in our language in a relationship that is a person who is more than acquaintance and less than a friend.
That's a wonderful question, and I'm off the top of my head, I do not have an answer for that. So if there isn't, it would be delightful if there were, and I cannot think of one.
What do you think about things like Urban Dictionary?
I think it serves some purpose, though I have to tell you that some of the lexicographers who I know are rather against it. And I've even heard them say that it's very useful because whenever they have a question about something, they look to see what Urban Dictionary says, and they do the opposite.
By the way, we should remind people, this is this online compendium where everybody can put in the words that they've made up or heard or slang terms, things like that.
Yeah, and I think it will have some use as time goes on, but I think it depends on what you view the role of the dictionary as being. And most lexicographers, I think, do have a kind of misunderstood role, which is that the dictionary really is set up kind of like an urban dictionary, which is that they look for how the language is used, not how it should be used or how they want it to be used. They just look for actual evidence of how these words and expressions and phrases are being used. And if there's evidence to back it up, they will put it in the dictionary. It's a kind of slow process with most dictionaries because they have to wait till they see it being written in a variety of places. But it's really, in a way, not that much different than urban dictionary. It's just that it's being done by people who are perhaps trained professionals as opposed to just people who want to put in whatever they think.
When we say that you read the whole thing, we should clarify, this means everything. There was nothing that you skipped, you didn't go through, and if a word said un before it, understand.
No, I didn't skip anything, though. I do have to admit that, the OED is different than most of the dictionaries in that they've tried to encompass the entirety of our language. So there are some citations and things that are written in Middle English or Old English, and I would try to read them, and I'm sure I have a certain degree more facility with this part of our language than I used to, but I'm really not fluent in Old English. So I would read over it. I try to get the feel of it, but there are definitely things that I did read, but I did not understand.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Anne in Richardson. Hi, Anne.
Hello. My question is, while you were going through the dictionary, did you make a list of subjects that you wanted to learn more about at a later date? And what would you pick five of those and tell us about those?
That's an interesting question. I did not make a list of subjects, but what I did do is I had an enormous kind of old binder from the 19th century. It was a ledger, actually, from the storekeepers used to have. It's about 500 pages of kind of lined but blank paper. And every time I came across any word that I thought might possibly be interesting, I wrote it down. So I was really just interested in the words and not so much in other subjects. But I ended up writing down about 10,000 words that I wanted to, have a handle on or that I wanted to be able to come back and read. And so on occasion, I'll sit down with my kind of notebook from this process, and I'll just read through it, and I get reminded of all the words that I wanted to be reminded of. So not so much subjects, just as much as the general vocabulary.
Did you notice a pattern to the words that you retained after you learned and read them and the ones that sort of fell out of your head?
No, I didn't. Well, I guess you would say, yeah. I think different people are struck by different words or different kinds of words. And, one of the things I mentioned earlier is that everybody is struck by almost everybody is struck by this word petrichor because they all know the smell of rain coming off the ground, or almost everybody is struck by this word apricity because everybody's felt the warmth of the sun in wintertime. I'm a little cantankerous, I guess, so I found myself struck by words that described unpleasant people. So words like sialoquin, which is a person who spits when they speak, kind of stuck with me. Or a word like avigilus, which is somewhat greedy, kind of a remarkably specific word. So I think I was more struck with words for people who I do not like.
I thought a funny word was mammothrept, which is a spoiled child or infant, and the etymology of that is really funny.
Yeah, it comes from the Greek, meaning raised by your grandmother.
Who wouldn't be spoiled if raised by a grandparent? 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to John in Arlington. Hey, John.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I was going to ask, when I was in school many years ago, I had an English teacher who said that the proper use of the word constant was that it never ceases, that it's always like pi is always 3.14 and so forth, and that continuous means it happens and then it happens again and then it stops and then it happens again. So is it proper to say someone is constantly snoring or constantly doing some activity when, in fact, they don't constantly do it. They do it every time that they do it.
Do you have an opinion on that, Ammon?
I would say that I tend to shy away from this kind of question. Difference between constant and continuous. You know, it's. I don't have an opinion. I would say that if you think that it's expressing what you mean it to say, then it's fine.
Well, you go to great pains to point out that you are not a professional lexicographer, but I have to wonder if you don't think that at some point you have earned this as the world's most prodigiously read amateur.
Well, you know, it's a good question because I don't think, I mean, again, I do like to stress that I'm not a professional lexicographer or linguist. The one thing that I do notice, though, more than anything else, I think, through reading the dictionary, is how much language changes and how hard it is to say something should be used one way. I feel like every time somebody comes out and says this word does, you know, whenever somebody says that's not a word or that's the wrong way to use that word, it's you're getting kind of on thin ice. Because so many words have changed meanings so often, or, you know, over the course of time that you can say, well, that word doesn't mean this, but maybe it used to mean that. Or maybe within a certain group or a certain community, it does, in fact, mean that. And it is kind of like the great line from Alice in Wonderland. You know, I forget who she's talking about, I think the Cheshire Cat. You know, what does that word mean? And the response is, it means exactly what I mean it to mean. you can go a little too far with that attitude, but to a certain extent, I think, you know, some words do mean what you mean them to mean, or what you want them to mean.
Ammon Shea is my guest. His book is called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. Let's go next to Srinidhi in Plano. Hi, Srinidhi.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
My question is, out of the 21,730 pages, what percentage of English OED has its roots in other languages? I mean, English has a lot of words which are taken from other languages. So what percentage did the interviewee find which belong to other languages?
Well, one of the things that is interesting about English is that it's a Germanic language. It's, you know, the structure of English comes from Anglo-Saxon. It's not a Romance language like Spanish or you know, Portuguese or French. But most of its vocabulary does come from Romance roots, does come from Latin or Greek. And I'm not positive on this, but I think it's about 70% of the English vocabulary comes from Latin and or Greek roots. I think it's somewhere around there. It's a little hard to tell, but I think it's maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30% comes to modern English from some other form of English, Middle English or, you know, Old English. But the overwhelming majority of our language does come from some other language. It's well over half.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bob in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Okay. Chris, I had a question for you. You sound like a very tolerant guy, and I'm pleased to find somebody else that reads the dictionary. I was wondering if you find it hard to tolerate sometimes people's very imprecise language, like when they substitute envy for jealousy, things like that.
No, I don't, because, you know, whenever I start getting bothered by it, I realize that I myself am my own speech, my own writing is, I don't know if it's full of mistakes, but I'm certainly not immune to using language improperly. I think it's delightful to hear speech or to read writing that is well thought out and really methodically put forth. That's well done and, as you said, precise. But I don't so much take issue with hearing the language used poorly sometimes.
Well, it's interesting, even, you know, and he brought up envy and jealousy. It that almost seems like one of those terms that, although the dictionary definition may be different, everybody knows what you mean when you say, oh, I'm jealous that you just got a new car, instead of envious.
You know, envy is actually a kind of great example, or I think it was envious is a word, which is changed. You know, somebody, I think, once said, you know, that there's somebody asked me, I remember one time, the question that, you know, there's that German word Schadenfreude, which is becoming an English word, which means taking pleasure in somebody else's misfortune. And they asked, well, is there another word for being unhappy when somebody else succeeds? And that, in fact, I think was the original meaning of envy, was not just desiring of something else that someone has, but the original meaning several hundred years ago was the state of being unhappy at the success of another person. So that's a kind of a delicate shift within the word, but it is a real shift. So, you know, I think envy can mean, in some sense, what you want it to mean.
I wonder if it's frustrating for you in the dictionary that, and we're having people call with questions about, is there a word for this or that, when you want a word for something but don't know where to go looking for it?
Well, that is hard, and that is one of the kind of intrinsic problems of a dictionary, is that you find words that you know how to spell or something like that. But that's also one of the things that is really kind of delightful about the Oxford English Dictionary online. And as I said before, I am emphatically in favor of reading as a way of taking in the dictionary. However, you can go to almost any public library and they'll have access to the OED online, and they have this great advanced search function where you can search for words, not just head words in the dictionary, but anywhere in the dictionary. So if you wanted to look up, for instance, a word that gave you the smell of rain, you can go to the advanced search page and type in smell and rain, and it will tell you all the words in the dictionary that have smell and rain in their definition. And it'll tell you this word petrichor, which is the smell of rain falling on the ground. So they're getting better at enabling people to search for things this way. As far as I know, the OED is currently the only dictionary that allows this kind of searching of its text. But it's a great way of finding words.
Writer Ammon Shea is my guest. We're talking about his book, Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Ammon Shea. His new book is called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. It has just been re-released with a new afterword in paperback. I'm wondering, Ammon, if you think that in terms of effective communication, it is possible to know too many words.
Sure. I found that as I spent more and more time reading the dictionary, my ability to speak to people became worse and worse. And I think part of it was that the more words, new words I crammed into my head, the more I would forget old words, many of which are useful for just talking to people on an everyday basis. And I think at one point I realized this when I went into a store, and I was looking for milk, and I asked somebody, I could come up with was the cold white stuff. I just couldn't draw to mind the proper word.
So milk was pushed out of your head.
Right. I lost that for a while.
And you also learned the word for when we can't think of the right word for whatever reason.
Onomatomania, which is, it has, again, several different meanings, one of which is fear of a particular word. But the meaning that I found most enchanting was vexation at being unable to draw the right word to mind.
It happens all the time to me. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in Garland. Hello, David.
Hi. I've been told most of my adult life that there is a word that there does not exist in the English language, and that is of a parent who loses a child, that we have a word for someone who loses a spouse, which is a widow or widower, and someone who has other kinds of losses, but there is no word for losing a child. Is that, do you think that's on purpose, or do you know of a word?
Losing a child, huh? I don't know of a word for that off the top of my head, and I would not say that that happened on purpose, because there are words for so many other kind of horrible things that it seems to me that the English language does not shy away from having words based on their whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. So I think it's just possible that one never came about, but I wouldn't know why.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Samuel in Fort Worth. Hi, Samuel.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
English is my second language, and I have been trying to learn this thing as much as I can. Can you ask your guest, is it possible to find a dictionary that is in voice, maybe like a CD or DVD? You have the words and they pronounce it, so you can learn after it, so to pronounce it. Because I have a hard time pronouncing some words, and people will say to me, what did you say? What did you say?
Mm-hmm. An audio dictionary. Well, that's an interesting idea.
You can actually go online. Although I have to say the Oxford English Dictionary is my favorite for terms of pronunciation, I would say go to Merriam-Webster, and it's a hyphenated word. It's Merriam-Webster. And that's the only real Webster's Dictionary. A lot of people use the name Webster's Dictionary, but Merriam-Webster are the actual heirs of Noah Webster's company. They have their entire collegiate dictionary, which is a very, very good dictionary, available for free online. And you put the word into the search box, and then you can also click on a link that will pronounce it for you. So they, on almost all their words, this is maybe 150,000 words of vocabulary, they will give you an audio pronunciation online. So that's a great way to get it. And if there are several different pronunciations, they'll give you 2, 3, sometimes 4 different variants.
How often do you sort of force yourself to stick with pronunciation number one?
I guess usually. I mean, it's I'm so terrible at pronouncing words that I usually just go with what I think is least likely to get me laughed at.
And your girlfriend is a former lexicographer,
yeah,
is that
she right? Actually worked for Merriam-Webster for several years, which is just one of the many reasons why I think they're such a fine dictionary company. But yeah, she was a former lexicographer on Merriam-Webster's 10th Collegiate. So she laughs at my pronunciation all the time.
Do you guys argue about words?
No, not so much.
I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And you have 1,000 dictionaries at your house, is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's 1,000 volumes of dictionaries and word books. And some of these, I mean, you know, it's not really 1,000 dictionaries because, for instance, the OED is 20 volumes long. So most dictionaries are not quite that large or don't have that many volumes. But I have been collecting them for the past 15 years or so.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, and fascinating program. One thing that I understood very well what your guest was saying was the fact that I think for many of us, the online books or the Kindles and all of that will never replace holding and, like he said, smelling and feeling a book. And as sort of a tag on that is that I have discovered that a lot of fairly late graduates of law school are so computer dependent for their briefing and that sort of work that they don't know how to use a law library that has books. Mm-hmm. But I'll just hang up and let y'all talk about it.
Thanks for your call, Mike. What do you think about that, Amy?
It's an interesting shift, I think, that we're going through. I feel like, I'm 38 years old, and I feel like I'm of a generation that's kind of between books and computers. I know how to use a computer, but I wouldn't say I'm proficient at it. But I have some limited degree of comfort with computers. I do research on them, and in some ways I think they're great. I do certainly prefer the feel and all other senses. I prefer having a book. But I recognize that there are plenty of people who are younger than me who do not feel that way. And it's an interesting question of what is being gained and what is being lost. There's no question that something is being gained with this shift towards computer literacy or the shift towards putting books. I mean, you can have a 1,000-page book, and if you want to find the word, apple in that text on a computer, you just search and you instantly find every time they use the word apple. That could possibly take you days to find if you're searching on a book. So there's something, there are many things that are being gained, but I think we also need to take into account what of the reading experience is being lost. I don't think it's at all clear yet what's shifting here.
Do you have friends and acquaintances who are trying to push you to try a Kindle or sort of experience that whole way of reading?
No.
They just know you too well.
Maybe they know better, or maybe they just have the same sensibility.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Maria in Dallas. Hey, Maria.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest, I heard that he doesn't have any reading knowledge of the French language, but if he had any familiarity with sort of common slang movements within various cultures or countries. There's a French slang movement popular primarily among the youth called verlan, which takes words, divides them up via their syllables, and then inverts them, in some ways akin to American Pig Latin. There have been actual published dictionaries of verlan. I was wondering if he was familiar with them or familiar with any other countries or communities that have similar things.
I'm not. I mean, in a way, it almost sounds like Cockney rhyming slang, which is I've always been fascinated by, but also confuses me horribly. I've spent a few summers in Paris, and I really should have much, much more facility with the language than I do. So I'm not at all familiar with it, but it does sound pretty fascinating.
Were you able to enjoy recreational reading during the year that you were going through the OED?
Yeah, sure.
So you would come home after 8 or 10 hours and sit down. What other kinds of literature did you crave during this time?
I guess things that I would just normally read. I read a lot of history and a lot of biography. I enjoy all kinds of memoir. You know, one of my favorite words that did not make it into the OED, and I'm not certain why, I've seen it in the dictionaries, is this word adoxography, which refers to it's good writing on a trivial subject. And that's always been one of my favorite areas to read in, which is that if somebody is an entertaining or a facile or a really proficient writer, I feel like they can write about anything they want, and I'll enjoy reading it. So I read, I wouldn't say in any one specific area aside of dictionaries, which is what I read most. I read all kinds of other things. And I wouldn't say that it ruined any of it for me. It was just, I know this is hard for some people to imagine, but I did treat it like a job, reading the dictionary for a year, because I was, in one way being paid to do it by my publisher. And it really was just like a job. It was just like a very, very enjoyable job. And if you love to read, just imagine that somebody gives you your favorite book and it's going to take you a whole year to read, and you get to go sit down in a comfortable chair for 8 or 10 hours a day and read your favorite book. It's kind of a dream job in a way.
Let's go next to Don in Keller. Hello, Don.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Don.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a word for you. Honorific abilitudinitatibus.
Mm-hmm.
That shows up in the Merriam-Webster big dictionary, and in Funk and Wagnalls, they call it a different thing. They call it honorific abilitudinity.
Mm-hmm. Is that the Shakespeare word?
Yes, that's the Shakespeare word. And I just wondered why there was that difference between the two big dictionaries and why Funk and Wagnalls hasn't really caught on like Merriam-Webster.
It's something that you find, dictionaries never agree fully unless one is completely copying another one, which did used to happen more than it happens now. It's, you know, they may have gotten it from different sources. They may have gotten it from different editions of Shakespeare. And then it's almost possible that one of the two just made a mistake. I've never compared those two words in those two dictionaries. Funkenwagnos used to be considerably more popular than it was now. There used to be an expression in the 40s and 50s that was popular. Just look that up in your Funkenwagnos, are the kind of colloquialisms that we used. But I don't think that they ever really kept updating their dictionary the way that Merriam-Webster did. Merriam-Webster is a great dictionary. It's a great company. They do wonderful, wonderful scholarly work. And one of the reasons why Merriam-Webster has remained so prevalent and so well used and loved is that they're always working on remaining current. I think about every 10 years they come out with a new edition of the Collegiate Dictionary. And every time they do, they replace or change drastically about 10,000 words in that book. So they're constantly keeping up with the way the language is shifting. So it's always a very kind of useful dictionary to have around.
Do you have, Emmett, a particular word that you look for in a new dictionary to judge whether or not it seems pretty complete?
No, I wouldn't. I don't. Because it's one thing is that I don't think it's ever fair to judge a dictionary based on one word. A great example of that in the OED was when they first published it, they did an installments between 1884 and 1928. I think there were 75 little kind of large booklets that came out that were then bound together. It was in the 1880s when they were doing parts of the letter A, they didn't include the word appendicitis. And the reason they didn't include it was not because they didn't know what the word appendicitis was. They just didn't think that it was common. They spoke to a couple of surgeons and really prominent doctors, and the doctors all said, "Yeah, you know, it's a word. It exists, but it's such a rare medical condition that you don't really need to put it in a general English dictionary. No one's going to want to look it up." And I think it was 1908. It was early 1900s. The coronation of Prince Edward VIII or something was delayed for several weeks because he had come down with appendicitis, and suddenly every newspaper in the world was writing about this medical condition, appendicitis, and all these people went running to the dictionary and wrote angry letters to the OED about how is it possible that you don't have this incredibly common word, because it didn't used to be common before that year. So it's hard for a dictionary to tell what is, you know, going to be common or what's, you know, what's going to come into play.
Did this undertaking diminish your enthusiasm for reading other dictionaries? I mean, once you've read the OED, does everything else pale in comparison?
No, I wouldn't say so, because I do spend more time reading the OED again now than I do reading other dictionaries, but they really are all different. I mean, the way that I like to phrase it is that they're all telling the same story, but they're all doing it in their own fashion. The dictionaries will all have a different way of treating the language. So everyone, as long as it's well done, is going to have something special in it. It's going to have something that no other dictionary has. And they're all just a beautiful way of looking at the language. They're all telling the same glorious story, which is the story of our language.
Emmon Shea's book is called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 Pages. Emmon, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.